sees him, which means the dad never stopped looking. And he runs out to him. And he throws a party. But the dad, who never stops looking for his son, notices that somebody else has wandered away. The good one. The one that grew up in church. That did all the right things. Now he's out. And he won't join the party. I want you to imagine you're the dad. How do you get him back? Because if you only knew this much, if all we had about Jesus was Luke 15, I still think you would know much about the heart of God. He's trying to get everybody in the party. How do you do it? Because we're not good. We church people aren't that good at throwing parties, are we? I grew up in a really great but really conservative culture in Arkansas, and my mom went to her church that she grew up in Russellville on her birthday. It was like a Sunday, and it happened to fall on her birthday. And anyway, my mom, everybody in the church she's basically related to. And so as soon as the service is over, they decide that they're going to sing happy birthday to her. And I'm like this, I'm homeschooled, I'm sheltered. I honestly did not know what the word I said meant. But at the end of it, I had hung out with like other people for the sake of this sermon. We'll just call those people pagans. And they had told me like certain words, or I heard them say certain words, but I didn't know what they meant. And so at the end of the service, when my Uncle Ricky starts singing happy birthday to my mom, at the end of it, mom's little 10-year-old boy goes, in front of all her church family and actual family, I go, "And many more, kick her out the door. 'Cause she's a promiscuous woman." Except I didn't say promiscuous woman. And actually, immediately, the whole church was like, "Ew!" And everything stopped, and everybody looked at me, and my dad, the way I remember it, like grabs me and takes me outside, and we have a little talk, but I don't think we talked, if I remember correctly, that much. We know how to rule, like never say words that you don't know what they mean in public. Because every party has a pooper, right? And I just happened to be the one that day. But what's interesting to me is how bad we are at celebration and how much we actually have to celebrate. I want you to think about this. The only time you tone down your passion probably is church, right? Am I right there? Is church tend to be the place where you are the most reserved with caring about what it is you care about? And is it because we don't know the story? Is it because are we trying to be reverent? What is that that makes us decide to hold back? So when I was in India a few years ago, my wife and I, we were working with this orphanage, and we were in this little like house outside the orphanage when we heard these gunshots. In like the middle of the afternoon, we're just taking a nap, and we hear these gunshots right outside our little house. And so I was like, "Leslie, go check that out." And she wouldn't do it, and so I had to go out there and check it out. And it turned out it wasn't gunshots. It was actually fireworks. And there was this group, like this little band of people was gathered around this tree, and tied to the tree was a goat. And they were shooting fireworks and just yelling stuff like that. And so I was like, I asked one of the orphanage workers, like, "Hey, what's going on over there?" And he was like, "Oh, they're about to have a sacrifice." And I was like, to that goat? And he was like, "Yeah." He's like, "We don't know if they're Hindu or Muslim, but we'll be able to tell by the way they sacrifice the goat." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, if they're Hindu, then they'll kill it a certain way. It's called Zagoth, and they just kill it, just real quick, one quick blow. But if they're Muslim, they'll kill it in a way of halal, which is they will stab it and slowly pull out the knife while reciting Muslim prayers." So if you're the goat, you're thinking, "Please be Hindu, please be Hindu, please be Hindu," right? And it struck me, because this is like a really primitive thing, right? This is a primitive thing, but it's actually happening in lots of parts of the world. It still happens. And what we talked about last night, in case you weren't here, was how important this whole thing was when God first set it up. Because in the ancient world, and these are the kind of two categories that we're faced with. In the ancient world, the gods were kind of viewed as bloodthirsty. And now, today, we think of God as kind of this morally neutral force that can be accessed at any point, at any time. It's a very kind of almost Christian idea. But we lose how powerful this idea is when we forget how we got here. And I don't know how to write like a pro-animal sacrifice sermon. I'm not trying to actually say we should bring this back or anything, but we do owe a lot about what we think about God, what we think about faith, to the blood of sheep and goats. Because the first people that God called into existence, the Israelite people, they weren't that reserved. They actually were really expressive. And they knew something that I think we've forgotten, which is that faith is not just something you think. It's not ideas. Faith, to many of us, is just like kind of this cognitive, you know, belief that bounces around in your mind and really has nothing to do with reality. And so what God had the Israelites do was tangible stuff. To see their sin, to deal with the evil that was in the world and in them, he would have them do these things like sacrifices to name just how bad the world was. But, like we talked about last night, Leviticus had this revolutionary new idea that was unheard of in all the other religions, which is basically that you could be at peace with God. You could be at peace with one another. If I stole something from you, if I intentionally hurt you, if I intentionally betrayed you, there was a way for the relationship to be repaired. There was a way for God to be reconciled with God again. There was a way for the younger brother and the older brother to get back in the party. Leviticus was actually this huge revolutionary new idea. Matter of fact, did you know that of all the books in the Old Testament, God speaks the most in the book of Leviticus? Because that's the whole point about Leviticus. It has more direct quotations from God than any other book in the Old Testament. The whole point of Leviticus is this idea that God draws near, that you can draw near to God, that he's not going to eat your face off, that he's actually good and that he wants to be in relationship with you. And that's the reason this whole story started from the very beginning. God wants to be with his people. Adam and Eve, he's walking in the garden with them. And then they disobey. So he calls into existence Abraham and this group of people, the Israelites. But while he's giving them the law and the Torah, anybody remember what's happening while Moses is on the mountain getting the Ten Commandments? Yeah. I can't understand what you're saying, but I think it was basically a golden calf, right? They're having a party celebrating all the wrong kind of things, and Moses comes back down and he's like, what's going on? It's basically, imagine being on your honeymoon and somebody's cheating on you. Because that's what's happening in that scene. And so from that day on, God calls into a group. He's like, all right, Israel, just like Adam and Eve, actually called that the temptation story of Israel. Since that day on, he calls to existence this one group, this one tribe of Israel, the Levites. And he says, all right, they're going to be my priest. Israel, Adam and Eve, every human was originally going to be God's representatives on earth. But then that didn't work out, so he called one nation. And then that didn't work out, so he called one tribe of the nations, these Levites. And the Levites, these priests, were going to show the world what God was like. That was what a priest did. A priest put the divine on display. So if you wanted to know more about a religion back in the ancient world, you would go to their temple, you would watch their priest, you would see how they interacted, what they did, and you would learn about God. And in order to show you about what I'm talking about, I need some help. So Michael is going to come up, Captain Announcements is going to come up and do something for us. Because in this world, being a priest was an incredibly important task. A priest, like we said, put the divine on display. And so we need a priest, just to show you what we're talking about. Here is the head hole, Michael. Here, you figure that out. I'll just keep talking for a second. The priest shows the world like kind of God's intention for the world, who God is, what he's like, and what they would do. Yeah, you look like something other than a priest at this point, which is why, of course, we bought these. I'm not sure how that works. Okay, look, this actually, when we bought it,
came with a beard, but apparently you look like a sixth grader with ponytails right now. Beautiful, beautiful. Now, it's not just this that makes him a priest. It's not just having like a robe and those wonderful, what are those called? What? Yes, or overgrown sideburns, whatever those things are. It's not just that that makes him a priest. There's actually this kind of elaborate ceremony, and it involved lots and lots of blood. So what they would do in Leviticus chapter 8, they would, in order to make Michael go from being Michael to being somebody who puts the divine on display, they would take blood and they would put it on his right ear. Wait, that's your left. Homeschooled, sorry. They would put it on his right ear, on his right thumb, and then on his right big toe. And this is in front of everybody, they would take this blood. And then in Leviticus chapter 8, if you could put that up, then Moses would take some of the anointing oil and some of the blood from the altar and sprinkle them on Aaron, on his garments, and on his son and their garments. So he consecrated Aaron and his garments and his son and their garments. So he would take this and he would just put it all over the priest. And I mean, this is just like, you know, fake blood and all this stuff, but this was everywhere on him. And this was somehow a way of cleaning him. Can somebody give me a paper towel? That's the one thing I didn't think of. So this was a way that they would set apart the priests. They would say, this guy is different than all of you because all of you, you failed, right? All of us, we failed. We were tempted and we were found wanting. And so now the priests, for at least this chapter, are going to take care of our sin for us. And maybe you know Leviticus. Maybe you know the story about Nadab and Abihu, how poorly we did that. The priest eventually, matter of fact, not even eventually, like two chapters later, they fail. But what's interesting is what the priest did. Before they would become priests, they were set apart for guess how many days? 7. New creation. That's the point. Thanks, Zach. That's the point. This priest is going to be a new creation, an example of what God always intended from the very beginning. And that priest, this new creation priest, the priest that exists, you know, in paradise, like the Cuban bakery that Brian was talking about earlier, that priest actually is able to deal with our sin. And when the priest would deal with our sin, it would be a huge party. The Day of Atonement, the day where they actually dealt with sin, where they talked about the guilt of Israel, was actually the biggest party day of all. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Because in order for this guy to deal with sin, he's going to have a goat. And in order to deal with a goat, he's first got to deal with his own sin. And so what would happen was, Michael, the priest, would bathe. He would bathe ritually. And that meant that he would, every nook and cranny, he would bathe, and he did this publicly. Then he would go, and for an entire night, that he would stay up. People would read to him to keep him up, because the night before the Day of Atonement was a big night. If he's the high priest, if he's the one who gets called on to deal with the sin of Israel, it's a big night, and he can't have any impure thoughts. You don't want this guy to have any impure thoughts. If he's going to deal with your junk for you, you want this guy to have his junk in order. So somebody's going to take care of him, going to attend him, make sure he stays awake, doesn't go to sleep, have any dirty dreams. That's really why they did it. They didn't want him to have any kind of dirty dreams. So he wakes up the next morning, and then he goes and bathes again in front of everybody, right? And he bathes, and he kills a goat. He makes a sacrifice for his own sin. Then he bathes again, and he kills something else for the sin of Levi, the tribe that the priest came from. And then he bathes again. I mean, this is one clean and bloody dude at the end of the day. He bathes again, and this is all in front of all of Israel. They're watching this, like through a translucent screen. They're able to watch Michael prepare to deal for sins on their behalf. And then finally, he would enter into the Holy of Holies, where he would offer a sacrifice for the sins of all God's people. after three times of bathing in front of a crowded temple, he would offer a sacrifice in front of this audience. They would see him bathe, dress, go in, come back out. He was their representative before God, and they were cheering them on. And once he was finished preparing himself, the priest would go out, and they would have two goats. And one of the goats, they would kill. And the other goat, they would let go, and they'd call it the scapegoat. If you're one of the goats, you're thinking, come on, lucky sevens. You know, they'd actually cast lots to see which one would be which. And if you were the lucky one, if you're the one that was the scapegoat, here's what they did to you. In Leviticus, look at this, chapter 16. When Aaron had finished making atonement for the most holy place, the tent of the meeting, and the altar, he shall bring forward the live goat. He would lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the wickedness and rebellion of the Israelites, all their sins, and he would put them on the goat's head. Now, this sounds so strange to us. He shall send the goat away into the wilderness into the care of someone appointed for the task. By the way, that someone tended to be a Gentile, because if you're a Jew, do you want to touch that goat? That goat is one loaded goat at the end of this day, right? So they'd get a Gentile, and the goat would carry on itself all their sins to a remote place, and the man shall release it in the wilderness. And they'd want to get a trustworthy Gentile, because the last thing you want is for that goat to find its way back home, right? You don't want to, like, wake up the next morning with a goat with, like, your affair on it showing up, right? And that's how they would deal with it. They would kill one of these goats to make atonement for their sin, but then they would also, it's like it's not enough. Even that's not enough. And so this high priest would confess on behalf of all of you, because they had this idea that I think we've forgotten, and that is basically this: I'm responsible for you. You're responsible for me. That it's not just every woman, every man for themselves. That we're in this whole thing together. And I take responsibility for your sin the same way you take responsibility for mine. And what's interesting is that when it said, when they would all yell, send it away, they would actually yell the Hebrew word, Ahazel. Let me hear you say Ahazel. And it basically means take it away. Take it away. Take it away. They would say, get our sin, deal with our sin, get it away. And here's where this stops being a history lesson and starts being one of the most relevant things to our life. Because isn't that what we all want? Isn't that what we all need? A couple of weeks ago, I did a wedding for somebody in the community who's a new friend, brand new Christian. He and his girlfriend had a couple of kids together. They had lived together for years and became a Christian. He said, I'm going to get married. They also have some grandkids that are like, you know, they had kids when they were 16, and so now they've got grandkids who are like 8 and 9, and some of their kids are like in their 20s. And so they're community members. They didn't grow up going to church, and they want to do this wedding. And so we had this wedding on Wednesday night, and one of our campuses threw like this great party for them. Said, congratulations, Taurus and Jessica. And they showed up at this campus, and we were going to do the rehearsal at 6 and have the wedding at 7. They show up at 6:55. I'd planned everything out, like as far as I knew how many bridesmaids and groomsmen they were going to be. Like half their bridesmaids and groomsmen showed up. One of their groomsmen showed up like holding his jaw, he had a toothache. And like 2 minutes before the wedding starts, he says, I'm not going to be able to do it. I just got a toothache. I can't do it. So like Mr. Toothache bows out, and there's like a college student who is just happens to be right there when the other guy bows out. So I'm like, all right, you're going to be a groomsman. So he's like, you know, man of honor or whatever. He's just standing right there next to him the whole time. It looks like it's all going to work out, except for the fact that these people don't know how to do church. So like at one point, in the most like sacred moment where I'm doing the vows, one community member is like behind me on stage, not even in the wedding, taking pictures with their cell phone. Like, what is happening back here while I'm doing this whole thing? And then the recessional happens where the bridesmaid and groomsmen come together, and then another one comes together, but guess who shows back up? Captain Toothache. He comes back at the last minute because all of a sudden he's been holding like a kid, and he's like, I'm tired of doing this. So he brings the kid back up to one of the bridesmaids and hands it to her. And she's like, I'm in a wedding. He's like, take the kid. He's like, I'm in a wedding. Take the kid. And the whole church is just like, What's going to happen? Really intriguing. Eventually, they give him, she takes the kid and meets the other groomsmen, and they walk down the aisle together. And I mean, it's just this joyful, messy, beautiful, wonderful, awful, you know, wedding. And then I find out that one of their kids is a prostitute. The one who was in the wedding, who just got the kid handed back to her. And I'm talking to her after this, because the one thing that Taurus and Jessica did was make a meal for everybody. That's why they were late, because they were cooking all day long. And at one point, I'm talking to her, and here's what she says. I wish one day I could get married. She'd been doing what she was doing for the last 6 or 7 years. How can she? How can she get back in? Is there any way back in the party? Is there any way for like normal, regular church moral people to be in a party with her? What can make that happen? And it's not just people who are on the outside who didn't grow up in church. This is a question that is as relevant to us as anything else. I told you last year about Christina Kelly, the editor who worked for YM and Jane and Sassy, all of which are magazines I'm sure we're all here subscribed to. But she was talking about the celebrity culture, and she was talking about how she realizes how small she's made people feel by focusing and telling the stories of celebrities across the world. I mean, these people are photoshopped and airbrushed, and you know, their PR manager helps them put their best foot forward. And then she said, I realized that in doing that, I'm diminishing and dehumanizing everybody else. And then this woman who doesn't have any kind of religious background, Christina Kelly, says this incredibly interesting thing in this kind of autobiographical post. She says, is it any wonder that at the end of the day, I feel so dirty? She says, her actual language, I feel soiled. I don't know how to get clean. Like, what can wash us? Because that's what really our problem is. We rarely stop to be introspective. But even in our actions, we're trying to get clean. I've been doing this long enough, and I've been paying attention to my own heart enough to know so much of what we do is because we don't get this. We join that nonprofit. We give a little extra to that charity or that church, or we donate our time to the less fortunate, or we vote the right way. And then suddenly we find ourselves furious with people who don't care about the same things we do. We find ourselves so angry with people who don't vote like we vote, or who don't think that the nonprofit that we serve in is the most important, who don't read the Bible the same way we do, or don't have the same vision of justice or mercy that we do. And if we're honest, it's actually not about that justice. It's not about that project or that nonprofit or that charity. If we're really honest in our heart of hearts, it's not about that. And so that was the way we were getting clean. That was the way, at least, we didn't have to feel so dirty anymore. And then when somebody doesn't agree that, when they don't buy into that narrative, all of a sudden, all those things come crashing back in. And the problem is, can anything get us clean? Can anything really do it? Because if you pour all your life into justice, and I bet some of you here have, you're never going to be free. Look at your name tag, or look at your shirt. Look at the tags on your shirt. Where were they made? What about your socks? Are you clean? And if you've already gone through that, and you've done that, and you wore a bracelet, and it gets you free, then great for all those things. Great for fair trade and free, or whichever one's the good one, the free trade. I guess, no, whichever one. Good on you for doing that. What about the Native Americans? Is there any way to get clean?
Are we all just a part of this system too? Is there anything that can wash us? Is there any way that we can be back in the party? Here's a haunting thought for you. Any gospel that's good enough for Jesus has got to be a gospel that's big enough for things like the Westboro Baptist Church, the KKK, and Dr. King. Because the same things that would condemn the Westboro Baptists, in my heart of hearts, I know they're in me too. So is there a party big enough for them? Is there something God is up to? And does this have anything to do with it? You know, one of the interesting things about it, this guy's taken like 3 baths, right? Publicly. And they're not big nudity people in Israel. But they do this huge thing to show he's clean, he's clean, he's clean. And in the book of Zechariah, look at this. On the Day of Atonement, in the book of Zechariah, it says, then God showed Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right side to accuse him. And the Lord said to Satan, the Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this man a burning stick snatched from the fire? Now Joshua, the high priest, was dressed in filthy clothes as he stood before the angel. This is talking about the Day of Atonement, the moment when the high priest is anything but filthy. He's consecrated, he's set apart, he's clean. And I heard one preacher say, no. This is a vision of how God saw him. You think this gets you clean? You're still dirty. Because there's nothing that can wash it off, is there? Not even this whole ritual? Not even this whole thing? Is there anything that can get to that part where deep down inside I know I'm stained? Because in spite of all our best efforts to be good, to be moral, to cleanse ourselves, it's like God still sees our hearts, and our hearts aren't clean. See, back in the day, in the ancient world, there were 2 ways you could be clean. There were 2 ways you could be dirty. There still are. If you were a Jewish person, you could bathe and bathe and bathe and still be dirty. But if you were ritually clean, you could literally, I mean, there's texts like where birds would like poop on you and you'd be ritually clean still. And you would much prefer standing in front of God ritually clean than you would standing before God physically clean and ritually dirty. But then you got these passages like the prophets saying things like, even then, you're still dirty. One of my good friends, a guy named Richard Beck, wrote a book called Unclean. And in it, he cites some famous kind of sociological surveys that they did with people where they actually took people and they showed them what they told them was Hitler's sweater. Maybe you've heard of this like study, but basically what they did was they said, they tell them this like elaborate backstory about how their granddad stole some stuff in World War II and that this was actually came from Hitler himself. And when the Nazis, you know, had realized, just this elaborate backstory. And then they tell them that it was unwashed and that Hitler had last worn it. And then they ask these people, would you like to try it on? And what do they say? Every one of them. None of them wanted to wear it. And the research, I mean, it's consistent, but what's fascinating is why they say no. And Dr. Beck is like this great experimental psychologist. He's renowned. And this is one of the things he said. The reason is fascinating on why. People report discomfort being near or in the same room with the sweater. There's like a wicked fog that surrounds the object, and we want to avoid contact with it. What studies like this reveal is that people tend to think about evil as if it were a virus, a disease, or a contagion. Evil is an object that can seep out of Hitler into the sweater and by implication into you if you try on the sweater. Evil is sticky and contagious. And so we stay away. This ancient category of evil and being clean and dirty, and it's like we haven't lost that.
We're really kidding ourselves. Last year, my Uncle Hoyt died and drove with my family. My whole family went from Abilene back to Arkansas. My Uncle Hoyt was not what you would call a religious person. Last couple of years, he became a Christian. And we go to this funeral, and it was just the most bizarre thing because my other Uncle Kenneth is like really not a religious person, and we couldn't even get a hold of him. Like he didn't show up for Uncle Hoyt's funeral, but we didn't know if he was going to show up or not. And at one point, the preacher doing the funeral goes, Uncle Hoyt is survived by named my dad, and he said, and also his brother Kenneth. Kenneth, are you here? And I'm sitting on the front row, and I just see the preacher go, oh, Kenneth, you're here? Kenneth Stormont? Not Kenneth Stormont. And I immediately was like, what kind of moron is like not paying enough attention to the funeral to know like that you're not his brother, so don't raise your hand just because your name is Kenneth. But he goes on to talk, which I thought was just so funny. It's the first place I've told that story to. But I'm telling that story because later on in the funeral, he's talking to my dad. He's the only sibling there. And he says, look, I know you know a lot of the bad stuff about your brother. The last couple of years, your brother confessed everything. And then he said, everything. Way more than I wanted to know. And then he said this really interesting line. He said, if anybody went out clean, it was him. I thought, what an interesting way to say that. Because there is something about the gospel that seems to make some kind of promise that we could be clean. Not perfect, but that Jesus has something to offer for those of us who can't clean ourselves. Now, here's where it gets interesting, because the Gospel of John actually is written to people who have been kicked out of the Jewish synagogue. At least a lot of people think that. People have been kicked out of the Jewish synagogue. And one of the things that's interesting about it is towards the end of the Gospel of John, they bring Jesus before this crowd of Jewish people. They bring him to Pilate, and Jesus isn't alone, is he? There's somebody else. Anybody know what he is? What his name is? Barabbas, right? And they have to make a choice. Which one are they going to kill? And then the Jewish people say, not just Jesus, but they say, what? Let his blood be on our heads. And then they send him away. They send this guy away. They give him to a Gentile to take him away, and all the people actually say, take him away. Take him away. If you're a Jewish person, there's going to be these echoes of Ahazel. Take him away. Take him away. Because John is on the scene trying to tell us that there's something happening. There's a new sacrifice. And the earliest Christians looked back on this crazy left turn that they were taking in the story of God, and they started to realize something God had been doing all along. And so they would actually write to people who, when the Day of Atonement would come around, when Jewish people were having this big party and celebrating, and if you're a Jewish Christian, you're like, well, I've always done the Day of Atonement. It was like the one day I felt clean. It was the one day that I felt like, oh, at least I know where I stand with God. And the author of Hebrews is actually going to say something like this in Hebrews. The law is a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. For this reason, it can never, by the same sacrifice, repeated endlessly, year after year, make perfect those who draw near, that's Leviticus language, to worship. Now, if you're the goat or the sheep for the last couple thousand years, you're thinking, now you tell us. Basically, the author of Hebrews is saying, yeah, look, the blood of sacrificing a sheep or a goat, that's not bad, but it's not going to be the... I'm sorry, it was an opportunity and I seized it. But it doesn't work. So why in the world would they do this? Why this elaborate setup with goats and sheep and blood flowing and making a river flow red? Why would they do this? And the Hebrews turns it around and says, why do they have to keep doing it? If it worked, why would they have to keep doing it? for the worshipers would have been cleansed once and for all. That's the way it works, right? And they wouldn't have to feel guilty for their sins. So basically, is it working? Do you feel clean? And then going, but those sacrifices were an annual reminder of sins. It is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away Azazel sin. Therefore, when Christ came into the world, this is what he said. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, talking about God, but a body you prepared for me. With burnt offerings and sin offerings you were not pleased. Then I said, here I am, and it is written about me in the scroll. If God's not pleased with sacrifices, then why does he keep asking his people to do it? Because he knows us. And he knows if we don't have an honest appraisal of sin, it won't lead to mercy. If we don't have an honest appraisal, if we don't have an honest appraisal of what sin costs, that sin brings death in so many different forms. And then he says, I've come to do your will, my God. First he said, sacrifice and offering, burnt offerings and offerings you do not desire, nor were you pleased with them, though they were offered in accordance with the law. Then he said, here I am. I have come to do your will. He sets aside the first to establish the second. And by that will, we have been made holy through the sacrifice and the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Day after day, every priest stands and performs his religious duties. Again and again, he offers the same sacrifice, which can never take away sin. But when this priest, when Jesus, offered for all time one sacrifice for sin, then that priest sat down at the right hand of God. Every other priest, forever, their work was never done, because your sin is just limitless. And because the sacrifice didn't work. But now Hebrews is trying to talk to people who were thinking, well, maybe I should go back. So, do you not realize this whole thing was leading up to this moment? God wasn't doing that. This sounds so bloodthirsty. It sounds like God is some kind of angry Zeus. But God's not doing that for him. God was never getting this. It wasn't payment to God. It was him trying to meet people where they were and give them a way to look inside, name what was wrong, and a way to deal with them. Because that's what we need, even if we don't know it. How can the older brother and the younger brother get back in the same party? It's not that God's just angry, and if we can keep him from getting mad if we just give him enough blood. It's not that God needs Jesus to die, like divine child abuse. First off, that's a horrible picture of the Trinity. The Christian doctrine of the Trinity is this idea that it's God that died. That God lays down his life. And it's not that God is angry and needing to take out his anger. It's like, what can make you clean? Is there anything that can deal with that? Maybe you've heard the story of Brennan Manning, who died this last year. Brennan Manning wasn't always named Brennan Manning. That wasn't the name his parents gave him. He actually fought in the Korean War with his friend from Brooklyn. He grew up in Brooklyn with a guy named Rob. They were best friends from all the time growing up. They enlisted together, and they actually wound up on the front lines together. And so they were in like a foxhole during the Korean War. And Rob was eating a Baby Ruth while Brennan was talking about something. And all of a sudden, a live grenade lands in their foxhole. And Rob drops his Baby Ruth and jumps on the live grenade and saves Brennan's life. And years later, when he decided to become a priest, they asked him to give up the name he was given by his parents and choose one of a saint. So he picked the name of his friend, Rob Brennan. And later on, a few years later, he went back to Brooklyn to talk to Rob's mom. And at some point, he said something like, do you think Rob ever really loved me? And the mom said, how dare you ask that question? What more could he have done? What more could he have done to show you he loved you? And this is the point of God setting this whole system up, of creating a people that just infuriatingly he wants to draw near to, but every time he does, they draw away. How can God, how can the Father be in the party when the party keeps leaving him? And so, we find people like Francis Bufford describing what Jesus did on the cross like this. Jesus is all open door to sorrow, suffering, guilt, despair, horror, everything that cannot be escaped, and he doesn't even try to escape it. He turns to meet it. This is on the cross, and claims it all as his own. This is mine now, he is saying, and he embraces it with all that's left in him. Each dark act, each dripping memory, as if it were something precious, as if it were itself the loved prodigal child tottering homeward on the road. But there's so much of it, so much injured children, so many locked rooms, so much lonely anger, so many bombs in public places, so much vicious zeal, so many bored teenagers at roadblocks, so many drunk girls at parties someone thought they could have a little fun with, so many jokes that go too far, so much ruining greed, so much sick ingenuity, so much burned skin. The world he claims, claims him. It burns and stings, it splinters and gouges, it locks him round and drags him down. And basically what he's doing is he's making this whole idea of atonement. The thing that frustrates me so much is that we make concrete things abstract. And the reason I love that quote is because it makes the abstract things concrete again. Like, why did this not work? Well, you know. You know in your heart of hearts. You know the blood of sheep and goats can't deal with that. It can't deal with all the angry zeal, with all the drunk girls at parties that people thought they could have a little fun with. That what we really need to get everybody back in the same party, this isn't going to do it. Because this guy, he's always standing. And Jesus did what the blood of goats and sheep never could. And then Hebrews said, he sat down. Because Jesus' ministry is over. Jesus on the cross is saying, I am what comes after deserving. I am the shining that your shame cannot extinguish. I am the door where you thought there was only wall. I am the hope that comes in the dark. Jesus on the cross meets us in our darkest place. He is the goat that is sent away. He is the father that runs out to meet the prodigal and the older brother, trying to reach his arms out far enough to make a party big enough for all. That's what only his blood can do. And so in a minute, Reverend High Priest Michael is going to do what other high priests never could. He's going to sit down as a symbol, as a way of saying, this never was the dream of God. This work is done. That Jesus, once and for all, paid. There's no more blood needed. And when he does, I'd like us to do something that we don't do that well. I'd like us to transfer the passion and celebration that we have in all the other places where we're happy to right here. Because let me tell you, the world needs to see people who party for good reasons. And if you can like high five and cheer at a Lakers game, especially this year, but you know, like if you can do that normally, then you should be able to do that here. You should be able to do that for this. Because what it means is not just that this never worked, but that something did. That place that's dirty and stained inside of you has actually been unlocked, set free, that we're clean. I'd like to see grown men giving each other hugs, okay? And so in a minute, when Michael sits down, let's go ahead and stand up. When Michael sits down, let's celebrate something that's finally worth celebrating.